ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, you'll hear more exclusive audio recordings from my attendance at the 2017 TCM Classic Film Festival. If you listened to last week's episode, and if you haven't, then you definitely should do that, you might have noticed that I incorrectly presented an introduction for the wrong audio clip. My interview with Leonard Maltin from the red carpet played instead of Maltin's introduction to Rafter Romance. So thank you to the several people on Twitter who brought that to my attention. So we're going to start things off by rectifying that error and playing the correct audio. This is Leonard Maltin's introduction to the 1933 Ginger Rogers romantic comedy, Rafter Romance.
This is a really sweet, entertaining movie, and it won't tax your brain too much. It's like trying to see, you know, an Eisenstein movie early in the morning on my first day, first full day of the festival. So you've chosen well. This is a cute, fun movie. I'm very happy to be here to introduce it. I'll be seeing you all weekend long, depending on what snaky part of the schedule you take. I'm so happy always to be part of the festival, and I want to thank Delta for flying me in from the San Fernando Valley this morning. I made it on time. It was much faster than the freeway. That worked out great. Welcome. You're in for a treat. If you don't know that already, you are. And for me, the most exciting part is just being part of this community. If you don't feel it already, you will soon. He had an incredible life. There's a great biography of him, which if you haven't read, I recommend very highly. He was a larger-than-life figure. But before he became a larger-than-life figure, he was at one time the head of production at RKO. And RKO was constantly changing regimes. And that has a lot to do with what happened to make this movie disappear for decades. It wasn't available to see. And to explain all of that, let me introduce Lee Scientis, the longtime head of legal affairs. I just said it wrong, Lee, but you'll correct me. Ed Turner. And Dennis Millay, the director of programming, who has been with Turner Classic Movies since day one. Let's bring him up. When I say this film wasn't available for decades, it's one of a half dozen films that just vanished, went into kind of movie limbo. I'll let you guys pick up the story and explain why and then how you rescued it.
The saga started in early 2006 when a viewer wrote to TCM saying, why was the movie Double Hearts, a 1933 RKO pre-code drama, never shown on the channel? Because it was part of the RKO library that Ted Turner acquired the rights to back in 1986 and 1987, they wondered why it had never been shown. Well, the inquiry landed on Dennis's desk, and he fielded the inquiry to me, because I was the custodian of all the legal documentation, of all the RKO paperwork that was acquired along with the films by Ted Turner. So the paperwork was meticulously laid out, and through that paperwork, I found out that Double Hearts, which was shown at last year's festival, was one of six titles that were sold out of the library to Marion C. Cooper, who Leonard just mentioned. Marion Cooper was the head of production of RKO for 16 months, 1933-1934, shortly after he made King Kong. And part of his deal as head of production was to receive a participation on each of the films that were released during his regime over that 16-month period. Well, he left RKO, time passed, he seemed to be getting no participation checks. So in 1946, fast forward, he went to the head of RKO and said, what's the story? I haven't been given any money. So as part of a settlement agreement, he was given a lump sum of money and the opportunity to cherry pick the rights to four films that were produced under his regime. And the four films he chose were not only Double Hearts, but among them, Rafter Romance, which you're going to see this morning. Because Rafter Romance was remade, another one of the films was remade, he actually got the rights to six films. But in 1946, he acquired this, we speculate, for remake purposes. We're not sure. It's not clear in the files what's what. But they were owned by Gary and C. Cooper. And part of the deal was that he was to hold on to them and not show them at all. They destroyed all the prints on all the films, the original negatives, and a fine grain. And then we'll fast forward now to 1956, 10 years later.
So in 1956, he decided to finally exploit, and he had a business partner who had also worked at RKO and for Selznick named Ernest L. Scanlon, and he did a deal with Ibn A. Alexander, and as far as we can tell, five of the six showed on television, at least New York City, and they made TV negatives and removed the RKO logo, slapped Ibn A. Alexander on the beginning.
Ibn A. Alexander were the people that brokered the sale of studio films to TV. The mid-50s was when studios were selling their libraries to television.
So yeah, they made 35 negatives and some 16 reductions. And luckily, those survived in Marion C. Cooper's archives, and they were at Brigham Young.
Brigham Young University has, among its many great collections, has the Cecil B. DeMille archive, which is vast. It has the Max Steiner archive. It has Dimitri Tiomkin. It has some of Howard Hawks' materials, and the entire Republic Pictures music library. If you're looking for the score to an old Roy Rogers movie, it's at Brigham Young University in Utah. But they got Marion Cooper's materials, and they're very conscientious, organizing and maintaining all of that.
They had his letters, correspondence, all of that stuff, and it came in handy later when we were working on trying to unravel this tale and figure out exactly what happened.
Shortly after the TV exploitation in New York City, we think they only showed in New York City
five of them.
Five of the six films.
The one that was withheld was A Man to Remember, we think because Dalton Trumbo had been blacklisted.
So anyway, the films had a token TV release. Then, in 1959, Ernest Scanlon, the business associate of Cooper's, the former associate of Cooper's, convinced Cooper to transfer all right, title, and interest, including the copyrights of the films, to him because it would serve as an advantageous tax shelter. So, in 1959, there was a quit claim, and the rights were transferred over to Scanlon. However, later on, Cooper, realizing that there had been no financial gain while the films were in Scanlon's possession, asked to have the copyrights and the right title restored back to him. Scanlon would return his calls. So the films were left in a kind of legal limbo. Cooper had the film materials, Scanlon had the rights, but because of the party's inability to reach an agreement, the films became orphans, lost in legal limbo. Until the inquiry from the viewer in 2006, the films had literally not been shown except for small gatherings like Cinefest in Rochester, New York for almost 50 years. So what we did is we looked in the files and found out if Scanlon, we did a copyright search, and we found out that Scanlon still had renewed the copyrights. So
Except for
Stingery, the film that was part of the six, and A Man to Remember. What we decided to do, we did a copyright search, and we found out Scanlon still had renewed the copyrights. So he intended on holding on to the rights of the films without letting Cooper have any say-so in the matter. So anyway, we decided we've got to track down Ernest Scanlon. Ernest Scanlon, let's see what's the story. So I found in the files a reference to an Ernest Scanlon Jr. So I told Dennis, what if Jr.'s still around? So we did a search, and sure enough, we found out that...
Yeah, he was still alive, and we just looked him up in the phone book, and I called him up. And he had no idea that his dad...
He had no idea that he was still around in our family.
Yeah.
So we reached an agreement, and we found out that there were prints not only in Cooper's collection at Brigham Young University.
Not prints, negatives.
And also material at the Library of History. We made a deal for the films. It was in April 2006 that we got the inquiry from the viewer, and exactly 10 years ago this month, this week,
The film's premiered on TCM. Wow.
But there is a weird part of the story. So I was dealing with Ernie Jr. and he wanted to include his siblings, heirs, etc. So he was talking to nieces and nephews and all that. And then right when we were about to sign the deal, I called the house and his wife, Gloria, answered. And she said, Ernie died last night. And then a nephew became involved and, you know, it kind of slowed things down for a minute, but eventually it all worked out.
A happy ending. somewhat postponed and with a cliffhanger to move. We wanted to tell you this whole story because sometimes movie lovers and movie buffs can be a little impatient and demanding and say, why aren't you showing this film? Why are you sitting on this title? Why can't we see it? And sometimes there are complex reasons, and sometimes there are cases like this, there are many other cases like this of films that haven't been cleared. But in order to clear those paths and get rid of all of those obstacles, it takes determination. Now, it helps to have a paper trail, as you did, and because RKO's papers were so well kept. And sometimes there is no paper trail like that, and it's a lot harder. But you guys have shown like The Constant Nymph in recent years, which was a wonderful film with Joan Fontaine that was out of circulation for many years.
Yeah, Warner Brothers worked out the rights to that.
Mm-hmm. And thank goodness they did. So there's always hope. Why I remain eternally optimistic that even films that we think we'll never see may yet turn up. Maybe finding a print in a garage in Czechoslovakia, or maybe just some good elbow work, elbow grease, going into the digging into all of this stuff. So we owe these two guys a real round of applause and thank you. Without them, we wouldn't be seeing this movie. It did get remade in 1937, RKO, which was constantly in financial straits, made a pretty regular habit of remaking, and other studios did it too, but they remade this with James Dunn. And
4 years later.
4 years later, as a B-movie called Living on Love, which you also cleared in the process. James Dunn is a good performer. Whitney Bourne is sort of an also-ran and never really became a star. But you're seeing Ginger Rogers. The same year, she danced the carioca with Fred Astaire in Flying Down to Rio. So Ginger was still on the rise. She was not yet a full-fledged major star, but she was becoming a star. And so you'll see her, you'll see a very young Robert Benchley. He did his first cluster of movies in Hollywood for RKO in 32 and 33. You'll see George Sidney, who was part of played Jewish characters in the Coens and the Kellys movies, and was the uncle of the director, George Sidney. And you'll see young Sidney Miller, who also played Jewish stereotype kids. This is how you can tell it's a pre-code movie, actually. Films before the production code still had ethnicity. And that all went away, along with a lot of other things.
There's one jaw-dropping moment that you'll notice. I won't say what it is, but you'll know it when you see it.
In any case, it's a fun movie. It's short and sweet and does its job. William A. Sider, the director, was a guy who knew how to handle light comedy and did it very, very well. So I think you'll have a good time with Graft to Romance. Thank you all for coming. See you all weekend long. Thank you.
Next, we have some really funny audio from Shaun of the Dead director Edgar Wright as he introduces Stanley Kubrick's 1964 comedy Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. I wasn't planning on watching this film initially, but when I heard that Wright was going to be in attendance, it forced my hand. And Edgar Wright is actually a big TCM fan. He spent the entire festival watching movies with all of us. It was really great to see. But Kubrick's dark satire played great in 1964. It's even more terrifying to watch in 2017, politically speaking. But this was a great example of what watching these movies with an audience can do, because I've seen Dr. Strangelove before and I didn't really like it. But watching it with an audience, which included Edgar Wright himself, showed me both the humor of the story, the complexity of the narrative, and again, how utterly prescient it is to today's times. But enough of me. Let's hear Edgar Wright joke very candidly about having to do a screening at 9 a.m. in the morning after watching a film at midnight.
Who was also here for the Kentucky Fried movie at midnight. Oh! Yeah. So I'm not the only idiot. I only got asked to introduce two films at the festival this year, and I think it's head turn a prank on me because my two slots were midnight last night and 9 a.m. this morning. What the fuck is that about? Jesus. So I literally had about like 4 hours sleep. I have the, you can see I've got wet hair and everything. I could have easily, this is the thing, as I introduced John Landis, Jerry Zucker, Jim Abrahams, and Jerry Zucker last night, we did a Q&A before Kentucky Fried Movie. And then thought I should go home. And then I thought, I'm gonna watch the movie. And I watched probably about 75% of it before thinking, I have to be back here at 9 o'clock in the morning. So the people who put their hands up and myself were probably the only people to watch, in essence, a double bill of Kentucky Fried Movie and Doctor Strangelove. Anyway, but the reason I'm here on a 9 a.m. on a Sunday morning is for this movie. Picture this. A completely unhinged, sex-mad, power-hungry government official with the power to start a nuclear war and wipe out his enemies. his advisors helpless to stop him. Imagine also an ego-mad white supremacist on the Security Council. The president's son-in-law is a senior advisor despite having no government experience. A situation room set up in the function room of a Florida resort and golf club. This... Guys, I printed out the Huffington Post by mistake. This is the news. Sorry, this is the news. I'm tired, like I said. The real reason I'm here is to see this on a Sunday morning because it's A, it's the only outright comedy that Stanley Kubrick made, and B, it felt ripped from the headlines in 1964, and it also feels scarily pressing now. So actually, when Scott suggested this movie, which I've seen before, and I think I've seen on the big screen once, but because of, you know, the current climate, I thought, oh, I want to watch Dr. Strangelove right now. John Landis actually said to me last night that he never makes lists, but if he had to at gunpoint, Dr. Strangelove would be somewhere near the top. This begs the question, who held up John Landis at gunpoint to ask him his favorite movies? This is probably the crowd that would do it, though. I can imagine you, somebody coming up saying, what's your favorite Edith Head credit? I do say, the reason the TCM is my favorite festival, it is the only festival where without fail, the costume designer gets a round of applause every time. Okay, here's some facts, genuine facts about the movie. You know, this is a uniquely funny and scary satire showing the machinations of an incompetent government where their show of power and dominance is because of their insecure and ineffective masculinity. Kubrick first developed the movie as a straight adaptation of the nuclear war-themed novel Red Alert, which itself was released the same year. The novel came out the same year as Failsafe, which then came out as a movie by Sidney Lumet the same year as this, which is a very somber and serious counterpart to this movie. The nuclear arms race was a subject that intrigued Stanley Kubrick for several years. He had apparently read more than 70 books on the subject and subscribed to Aviation Week and the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And in the course of reading, he came upon Peter George's novel Red Alert and purchased the screen rights to make what he planned to be a serious film. As he started to work on the screenplay, he began to see the absurdity in many of the scenes and decided to write it as a nightmare comedy instead, which is when he brought in comedy writer and novelist Terry Southern to punch up the humor and flesh out the grotesque characters. This is a Kubrick quote. The idea of doing a nightmare comedy came in the early weeks of working on the screenplay. I found that in trying to put meat on the bones and imagine the scenes more fully, one had to keep leaving things out which were either absurd or paradoxical in order to keep it from being funny. And these seem to be close to the heart of the scenes in question. Another quote about this movie from Kubrick that's amazing, he says, confront a man in his office with a nuclear alarm and you have a documentary. If the news reaches him in his living room, you have a drama. If it catches him in the lavatory, the result is comedy. So obviously Kubrick and Terry Southern together, you know, also brought a lot of sexual imagery to the movie, which is something that dominates the scenes and also dominates the characters, or governs the characters rather. But some of the iconography is fascinating, like the opening sequence with the B-52 bomber refueling, in inverted commas, to the strains of Try a Little Tenderness. Even the iconic image of Slim Pickens on the H-bomb straddling it like a ballast. The sexually inadequate general obsessed with precious bodily fluids. Even the names, President Merkin, Dr. Strangelove himself, General Turgidson. Here's a couple of other trivia notes before we start the film that I will fall asleep in. The incredible Ken Adam, he of James Bond's villain there fame, was the production designer, and he does amazing work here, most notably the war room itself. Peter Sellers, of course, plays three parts, Captain Mandrake, President Merkin Muffley, and Dr. Strangelove himself. But he was also supposed to play the part of the Texan Major Kong. They actually started shooting this part with Peter Sellers doing the Texan accent, but Peter Sellers apparently didn't think he was nailing it and didn't want to do the part anymore. This might be an apocryphal story, but apparently he faked a leg injury to get out of doing that part. Then Stanley Kubrick was forced by the insurers to recast, and hence the amazing Slim Pickens is in the film. Like 1964, this is Kubrick's first use of ironic juxtaposition of music and image that he would explore a lot later in his films. You've got the refueling scene, as I said, played out to Try a Little Tenderness in the opening. And then, of course, final incredibly bleak moments set to Vera Lynn's World War II ballad, We'll Meet Again. He would, of course, go on to do this a lot in his career, most notably in 2001 and A Clockwork Orange. Another thing that John Landis told me last night, which I'm going to look out for, because I've never noticed this myself, and I don't know whether this is true, but you can tell me whether it is, or we'll see. Landis assured me that Peter Sellers, when he does his Strangelove bit towards the end and he starts improvising the unconscious Nazi salute, that was something that Sellers improvised on set, and that one of the actors in the scene, I think it's Peter Bull, starts breaking up and has to turn around to not crack up. Now, I've never seen that before, but I am going to be looking out for that today, so we'll see if that's true. I think that's pretty much it. I don't have anything else that I cut and pasted off Wikipedia. Since it is TCM, I always like at this festival that people clap whenever a major actor comes on screen. But I think for this movie, I would like you to clap three times for Peter Sellers every time a new character comes on screen. And let's just clap for Edith Head, even though she didn't do it. I'm going to be here. If I fall asleep, don't hold it against me. But let's enjoy Dr. Strangelove.
I can't waste any more time in playing what I consider my most coveted piece of audio, French actress Geneviève Bujold's introduction of 1966's King of Hearts. I've adored Geneviève Bujold since her performance as Anne Boleyn in Anne of the Thousand Days, which is one of my favorite movies, and when I heard she was going to be at the TCM Film Festival, it was a gift from the movie gods. Bujold certainly didn't disappoint, and in fact was genuinely surprised that so many people came out to see her, which is ridiculous to hear. King of Hearts itself is a very French film. It deals with a Scottish soldier infiltrating a mental institution during World War II. It's a very satirical film that looks at the insanity of the war itself, that is at times both funny and very sad. Geneviève Bujold's role is very small, but it's perfection nonetheless. So, you guys don't want to hear me. Let's give it over to the spectacular Geneviève Bujold.
Hi everyone! Hola, bonne nuit, maybe I should say. I'm so excited to be here to help introduce King of Hearts from 1966, Philippe de Broca's classic anti-war film, which became such a huge and important cult classic and remains so today. At one point, Philippe was a cameraman for army newsreels, and he said after experiencing that, he wanted to make comedies because real life was just too ugly. And I think here, King of Hearts is something that is vitally important to watch right now. It feels very relevant, and it's also beautifully done, so poetic, with a wonderful cast, which brings me to our very special guest tonight. I'm so excited. Please welcome Geneviève Bujold.
Before we start our conversation, I want to take a moment to say merci, merci, thank you to Turner Classic Movie. Because of Turner Classic Movie, I discovered American cinema of the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, with their great actresses and great actors and great stories and dialogue with intelligence and humor. And I also discovered, because of them, cinema of many countries in the world with their individual culture. So I'm very grateful. Long live TCM.
Beautifully said, and you know, speaking of impressive actresses, to look at your filmography is just so incredible. All the people you've worked with, Alain René, all your varied roles. Where do you place King of Hearts? How special does this film remain to you?
Well, it's still around, so that's good.
Yeah.
The Wet Girl is, it just happened. Philippe de Broca is like a brilliant child with a massive imagination, and he likes to play. And he invited a group of people to join him in a little town, beautiful and historic, called Saint-Lys, north of Paris, and we all played together. And Michel de Broca was his wife at the time. She was gifted and creative, and she decorated through her perception of what the characters were. We had the houdat, not trailers and motorhomes, just the little houdat she decorated mine with some beads and others with what she thought, you know, would help the character. I can't not talk about when it's lunch hour in on a film in France, that's a sacred hour. A big table was set outside with good food. And it was very, very, very kind of magical, the whole experience.
You can feel that. You can feel the camaraderie with the cast.
And without imposing anything on anyone else, you know, like for instance, I was very intimidated by Pierre Brasseur, who played the general. And we ended up playing chess together every night. And, you know, I don't remember who won or didn't win, but that big presence just in front of a chess set, that was nice. I was less scared of him.
I love your character. She has a real innocence and sweetness about her.
She's young.
She's, yeah, so beautiful. And of course, she's got her mad edge as well. What's the balance when you were playing her? What did you relate to the most?
Just doing what, you know, Philippe would say, action, and we're supposed to go around walking strange. It just came naturally. Nothing was kind of planned.
Well, you were saying how each of the characters represent something that they wanted to be.
Well, yes, that's what I think, that was who she is, but she also saw herself or felt herself to be a ballerina. And the Duke and the Duchess, that's how they saw themselves, and they behaved like that. They walked like this, and personally, since forever, I wanted to be a ballerina. Far back as I can remember, when my parents couldn't afford it. It's all right, but ballet is always the discipline of it, and the graceful movements with the music always fascinated me.
It's so beautiful, the way your character walks, the tightrope walking.
She is sweet, you know.
And you've got to work with Alan Bates, of course, who's so wonderful in this film. He goes through such a transformation. What are your memories of working with him?
Well, him, he's a decent man. He's generous. He's nice. And he always seems to be in a good mood, you know, from within. It's not put on. Alan is good. He's a great actor, also.
You can plainly see that in this movie. And it's amazing the journey that this film had, where it had a resurgence around the Vietnam War. People really related to it.
Well, we need it now.
Yeah, we need it now. Like I was gonna say, at one point, I was reading in Massachusetts, this film played for years.
Yeah, 3 years in one cinema.
It's amazing. Yeah, so when did you start to hear about the resurgence that it had?
Well, I didn't. I was busy making other movies.
Yeah.
But I know that it is considered a classic. I mean, it fits in this festival. That people who've seen it, they like it a lot. You're going to have an enjoyable evening. I know it. Your touch, it's funny, it's got layers. I was telling you when we first met a while back that at the end of the film, the character played by Jean-Claude Brialy, they were great French actors in that film, all great, plays the Duke, and there's kind of a moment of reflection, and he says in French, les plus beaux voyages se font par la fenêtre. Literally translated is, the most beautiful voyages se font are done by the window. It took me years to realize that the word window there is not just a window of the house or the asylum. So he's talking of another window, and that's the window I like.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons why this movie remains so popular, because that's the thing, it didn't just have its resurgence, but it continues to be played and experienced.
Yeah, it just exacts itself through the decade. And when you think of it, this was done half a century ago. Let's not forget that.
It must feel special for you to come out and see all these people who wanted to see King of Hearts again. Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. Because I hadn't been in Hollywood in years. I live very kind of private, close to nature, and to see the enthusiasm of the people of TCM, and people are smiling, and there's an enthusiasm, and there seems to be like a fascination and a willingness and waiting to see the film. So that's good.
Such a willingness to see you and hear you speak. So it's such a pleasure to have you with us right now. I mean, I was backstage and it was packed of people, but so many people coming up to you and saying, I just want to tell you.
And they sounded sincere.
They were. They were. So many genuine fans. Having films like this, I was trying to explain it. It's like, it's poetic, it's got a lot to say. What would you say is the main meaning, or what was the biggest thing that you took from the film when you first read the script or making it?
Well, I think love always. They have a community. All those people are crazy in the asylum, so they accept each other, unconditional love, and they're happy, and they support each other, and they play together, and war for them is like crazy.
It's such a contrast between them and then the sort of regiment of the army as well, which I think is beautiful.
Yeah, no, they could not have that kind of regiment. No, they're free.
Yeah, it's beautiful to see, and I know you guys are all going to enjoy it, so please thank Jean-Pierre Bouget.
As a TCM backlot member, I was fortunate to attend a special members-only meeting with Todd Fisher, who introduced a trio of costumes that his mother, Debbie Reynolds, wore in several of her most prominent films. So the next bit of audio you're going to hear is some of the snippets that I was able to record of him discussing his mother's costumes, working on The Unsinkable Molly Brown, which, if you'd like to get my thoughts on The Unsinkable Molly Brown, I did an episode couple months back about that, and more. Unfortunately, the best part of the audio is stuff that I didn't record, which includes a hilarious story that Todd Fisher gave about a John Deere tractor and a pig named Elizabeth Taylor, but sadly, that didn't get recorded on audio. Stuff here is very sweet, very funny, very heartwarming, so let's give it a listen.
Okay, so what are we doing? So we're going to do this documentary film, kind of like, you know, Carrie and I will sort of talk about you, and we're going to talk about your legacy and how we grew up with you, and, you know, we'll have fun with it, whatever. We're trying to keep it easy. It's like, okay, well, where's the script? And we said, well, no, actually, there's not a script. She said, okay, well, where are my marks? And we said, well, actually, there are no marks either. What kind of film is this again? Well, it's like a documentary. About us? Quite get the concept. if you guys remember this scene. Have you guys seen this movie on Single Mom?
Yes.
Now, this was, I think, if you see the pictures of my mom, I think the still pictures of her in this costume, she had on these ruby and diamond necklace. It's got to be the most stunning pictures my mom ever taken. Also, my mother had red hair. This is something amazing about her. She looked fantastic, at least my humble opinion. But that red dress with that jewelry and that scene with the little diamonds and everything, just, she was truly spectacular. There's a really cool scene that they've actually run on TCM before, where it's a black and white sequence where Morton Hack and they're sitting down and they're looking over the costume designs and all this is happening. I have the original costume sketches for these films, for both of these costumes, both of these. When you think about the process of how this goes down, Debbie was a pretty big star at the time, but you guys know the backstory. They didn't want her for the part. Not everybody knows that story. Right, so here's the
They wanted Shirley MacLaine.
They wanted Shirley MacLaine because Shirley was, they thought, more of a ball of fire, more of a Molly Brown, and she had red hair and all that. Debbie Reynolds, I mean, she's this little impish, kind of little frail thing, you know, I mean, wrong. She's a tomboy, highest order, but nobody really, they didn't really know that. Now, the director is a guy named Charles Walters, great director, great musical director. And he came to Debbie, to our house when I was a little boy, and he said, "Now, Debbie, I'm begging you, don't do this movie. You're not right for it. You're too small for the part." She said, "Well, how small is the part?" Meaning like she's joking with him. But he's like, no, not that. I mean, you're just, it's like you are physically just not tough enough to play this role. You just are not tough enough. You just got to break. So he was mad at her that she took the part. But my mother was like, "No, this part is me. You don't understand. I'm going to show all of you guys." So for the first week or so of filming and during this movie, she and the director aren't even talking. Not at all. So there's no one directing her. Now, after about the first week, along comes the film rushes, and then the director sees some of this stuff, and he's like, maybe I better step in here and work with this broad. So famously, they realize he flashed that she truly was made for that part. And when they saw her singing that song, you know, "I'm going to learn to read and write," she's marching over the top of that grass roof. That was all actually on a soundstage, both. Part of it was shot in Colorado, part of it was rebuilt on a soundstage. And when I was a little boy, I was watching her. I would play on that same roof. It's a set. And I saw her then do that scene on that roof. It was, I have to just say, even as her child, it was mesmerizing. You know, it wasn't like the woman, the mom at home that you think, "This is my mom," and, you know, and like, or is it my mom? I don't know what to think about. You know, you'd see her just, because I was still pretty young. This is 64. I'm, you know, I'm 6 years old. So it was pretty mesmerizing. This number right here is the Belly Up to the Bar Boys number. And of all of the numbers that were in the movie, there's two that are my favorite. One is "He's My Friend," which we have that costume as well, and this number. When I was a little boy, the guy that did the musical arrangements and worked with my mother to work on learning these songs, they would rehearse endlessly in our music room. And I would hear them play this song, and I used to listen over and over and over. Many times I'd walk through the room and the musical conductor would say, "Hey, what do you want to hear?" Now, you know, most kids would say, "How about a little Beatles, Stones, whatever." I could pick anything. I said, "Belly Up." As a little boy, I loved that song, "Belly Up to the Bar Boy." There was something just irreverent about it. But also watching her do that scene was crazy. I mean, again, the energy level in this scene, when she's dancing around. And this is the scene, by the way, that Charles Walters saw her do and just went, "I see." You know, that would shut anybody up, so to speak. Well, obviously, Singing in the Rain down here, not the least for last or last for least. That is certainly probably one of the most famous dance numbers in any musical. Yep. And I'm not saying there aren't amazing dance numbers, amazing musicals, but there's something so memorable about this. The idea that it's a musical that makes sense in the true sense. It's a movie about making a musical. So all of a sudden, all the musical stuff makes sense, right? Because we're now actually making a movie about making a musical, so we can get away with anything. But most musicals prior to this didn't have that rule. Maybe it's two people talking, and all of a sudden, you know, they break into song for no reason whatsoever. Look at The View out there. "You were," you know, like out of nowhere. "Look at the moon tonight," and they'd start singing about the moon. Maybe not even the moon. They'd be talking about something because they had a song that was left over that they had to use. So you'd have a song that makes no sense stuffed in the middle of a musical. That wasn't unlike MGM, but here was a case where this movie is a movie about making a musical, and they're struggling over the idea of making this musical, and that's what that number is all about, is them having this epiphany about how we might save this talking, this film and this talking era, this nightmare new era of technology in which we live today. The same thing they were struggling with, the advent of talkies, is what we struggle with today as an industry. The advent of the internet, the advent of people watching on other media. The idea that somebody is going to watch a movie on this screen is a nightmare to a film producer. Can you remember how long ago when they were having nightmares over the idea that the screen would just be a TV? I mean, that's when the birth of big screen came, the big wide screens. In fact, that's what Molly Brown was CinemaScope. It was the last of the big MGM musicals in many ways. This, if you think about it, this is towards the tail end of the big MGM musicals. In fact, it was the most expensive one of its time back then. Now, Hello Dolly at Fox later, but that almost broke that studio as well. We collected these costumes, not just these costumes, but many others. I brought up Hello Dolly, that gold dress. We had Streisand's gold dress. But we had every musical, all the way back to Ruby Keeler, if you know who she is. Ruby Keeler actually did a number of Singing in the Rain before Singing in the Rain. That was MGM always sort of hashing up more and more of this background stuff. But I'll tell you, watching her as a child, watching the show, it was like, I watched the show. As a child, I watched her go through life. I watched her not just be a mother at times, because there was a look. You ever had that look from your mom when you're in trouble? Okay, I got that look. I know that look real well. We all got that look, right? You didn't do your homework, you didn't clean your room, whatever the case may be. But then that same thing, I had this unique privilege of also then watching her create great art. It's something Carrie then recently was quoted by Meryl saying, you know, turn your pain into art. It's interesting that that would go that way, because Carrie became as much as Molly Brown as my mother was Molly Brown. Not just because she was raised by Molly Brown, although my mother was somebody to watch growing up, if she was someone to be inspired by. You know, you could hang your hat on what she said or what she did. You knew she lived a certain standard, a certain life. What you saw was what you got. Many people say, oh, you know, your mom just seems so whatever. You know, like, because she is so whatever. She's just like, wow, one of us. She's not like a big star. Well, yeah, she's a big star, but she didn't act like a big star. She's just like one of us. That's why she had a career that went 7 decades, because she had that connection with the people. Without those people, who are you? You're a shadow on film, as it said, right? They will forget you. How many movies you watch, even on TCM, you're like, who is that shadow on film up there? We don't know those names. But yet there's certain people, you know their names. They're on that wall over there. You know, there's people that have earned that reputation. And part of it has to do with the life that you live and the connection you have to your fans. And that is something my mother did. It wasn't just about the great moments in film. All right, I'm going to shut up because that was a long monologue. So
we'll briefly hit the TCM red carpet for a short interview with TCM host Ileana Douglas.
How are you?
Excellent. How are you?
I'm loving the outfit. Very appropriate to the time period of the movie, I think. I wanted to ask, actually, because, you know, this is celebrating its 50th anniversary. You made Grace of My Heart set in that same time period-ish. What do you think it is about the 60s that still endures?
It's a time where music, fashion, tumultuous history, and big hair. Really big hair and eyelashes. You know, just exactly. All came together.
You know what? No one's complaining. I always say that I probably would have fit in very well in the 60s. You got all the stuff. I love that this ties into something from your book. When you were kind of reaching how, as a youth, you could be a lot crazier going to see movies, you know, in insane situations. It probably would have put you on a milk carton at a certain point. But how has your film viewing experience changed? Obviously locations and all of that, but how you view films as you get older.
It's so funny that when Peter Bogdanovich told me that when he was 12 he was making index cards,
right,
with movies, and I think all of us who love movies were like, Oh, so that wasn't, that's not embarrassing, because I did that too. Just had this idea of seeing movies. For me, it really started with musicals. That was, I loved the Busby Berkeley musicals, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and I'd write down every person that was in the movie, and then I got into more classic films, Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, and then I discovered the director, Hitchcock. And so it's been, I've always, you know, listened, I guess, to my grandfather, like, how, that if I was going to be in show business, to have classic understanding and appreciation and knowledge, not just of actors, but of the writers.
Of course.
And sometimes the producers of some of these films. So that's what I've always tried to do.
Well, of course, the theme is make them laugh.
Yes.
What films make you laugh?
I mean, Heartbreak Kid.
Great one.
Is a killer. Young Frankenstein, probably one of the funniest movies of all time.
You've made several very funny movies, I think. Both dark comedies and...
Dark comedy. I'm going to be directing a comedy.
That's right.
That I wrote called Love is Funny. It's got funny in the title.
So you got to live up to that, of course. And we have no doubt that you will. So, Ileana, thank you so much for stopping. I appreciate it.
We'll close things out with Ileana Douglas's interview of director Peter Bogdanovich before a screening of The Last Picture Show. Much like Edgar Wright, Bogdanovich is a director with a serious reverence for classic cinema, as evidenced by his black and white opus The Last Picture Show and Paper Moon. Last Picture Show is a beautiful and tortured look at adolescence, with some amazing performances from the likes of Sybil Shepherd, Eileen Brennan, and Academy Award winner Ben Johnson. We're going to hear more from Bogdanovich next time, but let's enjoy him now talking about casting the film, his relationship with Orson Welles, and The Last Picture Show. Note, I apologize for the up and down of the audio, because Peter Bogdanovich is a very soft-spoken man, and it's not perfect to work within the limitations of recording in a theater. So, while Ileana sounds fantastic, Peter doesn't really seem to know where the mic is all the time, so apologies. But let's take things out with some great classic film history, courtesy of Mr. Peter Bogdanovich.
One of the quotes I found that he said is that I always had one foot in the past and one in New Hollywood, and I think that that is so beautifully reflected in his films and his work, especially The Last Picture Show, which is imbued with a sense of nostalgia, great knowledge of films, film techniques, starting with the achingly just beautiful, for those of you who haven't seen it before, Black and White by the late Robert Surtees. Newfoot that he talks about is that modern Hollywood representing, you know, new films, new filmmakers, the frank sexuality, the naturalness of the performance, the deft handling of cast, largely newcomers like Sam Bottoms, Sybil Shepherd, of course, veterans like Ben Johnson, which is a great story about how Ben Johnson came to be in the film. It's one of the great, it's a kind of an American classic film because it combines all the great nostalgia of old films with all the modern technique of new films. It was nominated for 8 Academy Awards, picking up 2 for Cloris Leachman and Ben Johnson. Of course, after that, his many other films, Targets, which is very prescient, of course, Paper Moon, What's Up Nickelodeon, They All Laugh, Cat's Meow, and currently She's Funny That Way. I was privileged enough to be directed by Mr. Bogdanovich. He's also a terrific actor, having appeared memorably in St. Jack, They All Laughed, and of course, The Sopranos. And the last thing I wanted to say about Peter that I think is so important is that he organized the first retrospective in this country of Orson Welles, then Howard Hawks, and then Alfred Hitchcock. The first in this country. I think that what's so unique about that is that so many of these masters that were around, possibly languishing, and he not only wrote about them, but he was friends with them. And I think that that is just so thrilling to be part of this TCM Film Festival and to be able to speak to someone who I consider a great master. So ladies and gentlemen, Peter Bogdanovich. A
Thank you. It's very early. I'm seeing a movie. This time of the day to see this movie.
You barely get
me to do anything at this time.
The first thing I wanted to ask you about, which is something that you told me, is that you've seen... How many movies do you think you have seen in your lifetime?
Jesus. Probably over 5,000 to 6,000, something like that.
And when you were 12, you started writing index cards, typed.
Yeah.
With all the movies that you'd seen.
I kept a card file of every movie I saw from the time I was 12 and a half until I was 30 and a half, 19 years. I have them still. I would write what I thought of the picture, and then if I saw it again, I would write what I thought of it then. And sometimes I would change completely from 12, when I was 12 to when I was 20. One time I'd like a movie, and the next time I saw it, 10 years later, I'd hate it. I guess that happens to all of us.
And then I wanted to ask, as I mentioned, about organizing these retrospectives at MoMA for Orson Welles and how that came about, because I think it's a very kind of interesting story, how you were chosen.
Well, I wrote a program note for a theater in New York, the New Yorker Theater. It's gone now, but it was a terrific theater. I wrote a program note in which I said that Othello, Orson Welles' Othello, was the greatest Shakespeare film ever made. And that was not the common wisdom at the time. Everybody thought the Olivier films were the best Shakespeare films. And I thought they were good, but they were photographed theater, whereas Orson's was a movie. So I wrote that. I get a call from Richard Griffith, who was the curator of the Museum of Modern Art Film Library, and Welles' films, and we'd like you to, I know you'd like to curate it and write the accompanying monograph. I said, why don't you do it, Dick? You usually do those things. He said, well, he said, I don't like Orson Welles. He said, but our membership does, and there we have many associates in Europe who think he's great, and we think that we should do it at the museum. Would you like to do it? I said, sure. And he said, we want somebody who's partial to Welles, and from your program note on Othello, obviously you are. And so I wrote it, and this was in 1961. And the following year I did Hawks, and then the following year I did Hitchcock at the museum. I sent the monograph that I wrote to Orson, who was somewhere in Europe shooting the trial, and I didn't hear anything for 7 years. But 7 years later, I was now in California, I get a call. A familiar voice says, Peter Bogdanovich, speaking, this is Orson Welles. I said, oh, hello. He said, I can't tell you how long I wanted to meet you. I said, wait a minute, that's my line. I said, why'd you want to meet me? He said, because you have written the truest words ever written about me. Pause in English. And that was the beginning. He said, what are you doing tomorrow? Can you come over to the Polo Lounge? And I said, sure. And we met. And that was the beginning of a long friendship and relationship and ups and downs. And I knew him until he died. Kind of amazing man, I must say.
He had a tie into the last picture show and your decision to make the film in black and white.
Well, we were having breakfast one day. He had read the script, which he didn't like, by the way. And when he saw the movie, he said, that's not the script I read. And yeah, it is. He said, no, it isn't. I think you transformed it. He referred to it as a dirty movie. But we were having breakfast, and I said, you know, I'd like to get that depth of field that you had in Citizen Kane, where everything's sharp and in Touch of Evil, you did it too. So, and then how do you get that? He says, you'll never get it in color. I said, well, you know, they've got faster film now, or something. You'll never get it in color. But what do? Shoot it in black and white. I said, well, I'd like to shoot it in black and white. I don't know if they'll let me. Have you asked? No, I haven't. Well, ask. You know what I say about, look, Peter. He says, this, your script is an actor's picture. It's all about the performances. And you know what I always say about black and white? No, what? It's the actor's friend. Why do you say that? Because every performance looks better in black and white. Name me a great performance in color. I didn't even try. You know, he's right. black and white does something to the performances. It also, because it was a period piece set in 1951, 52, that was a kind of more of a black and white period. So I did ask Bert Schneider, who was the producer, and he said, let me get back to you. And a week later, he said, okay, go ahead. A number of years later, I asked him why he had allowed it so easily. He said, I thought it would be a novelty, because nobody had done a black and white picture for a while. After this was successful, and then I did Paper Moon in black and white as well, a number of people did do black and white. Mel Brooks did Young Frankenstein in black and white. Bob Foster, Lenny.
Kind of brought it back.
Brought it back for a while. It's disappeared again. I'm sorry to say, because I love black and white.
There was another master helped Ben Johnson involved in the film.
Well, I thought Ben Johnson, I couldn't figure out who to get to play this very important role. How many of you have seen this film once?
Wow.
Quite a few, yeah. Well, then those of you who've seen it know how important the Ben Johnson part is. And I couldn't think of who to get for it for a long time, and then it suddenly hit me, Ben Johnson. My God, why didn't I think of that? Because we talked about having maybe Jimmy Stewart or something, and then I thought, no, we can't have it. He's too big a star. We're in the small town, and there's Jimmy Stewart. He's too big a star. So I got in touch with Ben, and I sent him the script, and he turned it down. I said, Ben, you got to do this picture. He said, no, Pete. Too many words. Too many words, Pete. I said, well, it's a great part for you, Ben. You really said, no, too many words, too many words. So I called John Ford, who had used Ben Johnson in a number of pictures, and I said, I've got a really good part for old Ben. He says there's too many words. Oh, Jesus, he always says that. When we did Yellow Ribbon, he'd come on the set, he'd say to the script girl, any words for me today? And if she said yes, he'd sulk. And if she said no, you just got to ride a horse, he was happy. Where is old man? I said, he's in Tucson. Well, give me his number, I'll call him. Would you? Yeah, I'll call him for you. About 15 minutes later, the phone rings, it's Ford. He says, he'll do it. Really? Yeah, he'll do it. I said to him, look, Ben, Peter's got a good part for you. What do you want to play? Duke's sidekick your whole life? Duke is John Wayne. He said, he'll do it. So I said, thanks so much, and thank you so much. And then about 10 minutes later, the phone rings again. My assistant says, it's Ben Johnson. I pick up the phone. Hello, Ben. You put the old man on me. Well, I really think it's a great part. Oh, Pete, I don't know. It's too many words. He still wasn't doing it, but he came to my office a week later when he got back to LA. And I talked to him and talked to him and talked to him. And finally, I said, Ben, if you play this part, and I swear this is true, you can get the Oscar for this. Why the hell do you say that? I said, I don't know. I just think you in this part could get an Oscar. Finally, he had the script in front of him open, and he slammed it shut. All right, I'll do the goddamn thing. And that's how he accepted the part. And he did get the Oscar.
Some other great casting decisions. You cast Sam Bottoms because you thought he had sad eyes.
Well, it was very strange. We had cast Sam Bottoms plays of a mute. We had another person cast that we found in Dallas, and he hadn't arrived yet, but he was cast. And I was driving into Archer City, which is where we shot the picture, and there was a kid sitting on the steps by one of the houses as we were driving in. And I said, hold on, stop the car a minute. And I went out and I said, who are you? He said, I'm Sam Bottoms. I said, oh, are you related to Tim? He said, I'm his brother. I said, what are you doing here? And we just came to watch Tim. I said, you want to be in the picture? He said, sure. I said, well, can you take your braces off? He said, I'm Dad's my mother. He was 16. He just looked right. He just looked like the part that I had in mind, much more than the kid that we cast in Dallas. So that's how he got the part.
And Jeff Bridges had a kind of certain likability that you thought would counteract his...
Exactly. Jeff's part, Dwayne, on paper, is not a very nice guy. But Jeff is so extraordinarily nice. guy that I thought that it would sort of make it more ambiguous, the character, and therefore more interesting. And so we cast Jeff. Jeff hadn't had a big part in a picture. He'd done some small things with his father. And he got nominated for an Oscar for this first time. And that was Jeff. Yeah, he was wonderful. I loved him. I love Jeff Bridges. I love him to this moment.
And of course, apocryphal, the casting of Sybil Shepherd.
Their guy hangs a tail. I was at a supermarket, and I was checking out, and there was a Glamour magazine right there where you check out. I never even heard of Glamour magazine, but there was this girl on the cover, and she caught my attention. Sybil didn't know who it was. She was a model at the time. She was wearing a shirt that had little I love yous all over it. I love you, I love you, all over the shirt. But the look on her face belied the sentiment on the shirt. I don't know if she loved me. I thought she was interesting. So in typical Hollywood fashion, I bought the magazine, plunked it down on my assistant's desk and said, find that girl. So we found out it was Sybil Shepherd, and she was a model that won the Model of the Year contest. They had that for a couple of years. And she was in New York. So I arranged to meet with her. Next time we went to New York, which we went to New York to cast for a while. She came up to the hotel with her manager, and she was wearing blue jeans and a jean jacket, very tall, and broad shoulders. And the funny thing about Sybil is, she photographs better than she looks. She looks great, but she photographs even better. It's amazing. She sat down on the floor for some reason. I was sitting on a couch, and in front of me was a coffee table with the breakfast tray that I had. And you know when they send you in a hotel, they give you a vase, some little vase with a rose in it. And she was sitting in front of this coffee table. And while we're talking, she starts flicking the rose, like this. Just like that, bang, bang, bang. And I thought, that girl could do the part, because that's the way she treats men. So, I know it sounds crazy, but I remember that George Cukor, who cast Katharine Hepburn in her first movie, This is a Bill of Divorcement, I had asked George once how he came to cast Katharine Hepburn, and he told me, he said, well, she came in and we were reading and we were talking, and she had a cup of tea in her hand, and the way she put it down on the floor with her whole body, and I thought to myself, that girl. If Cukor's going to cast Kate Hepburn because of the way she puts the goddamn coffee, I can certainly cast someone who doesn't like the way she flicks a rose. So I didn't even read her. And she got the part. And then on the picture, we sort of fell in love, which was dicey because my current wife, was on the picture, a production designer. And things were not a happy, it wasn't great to experience that part. And my father passed away while we were shooting, suddenly. And it was just we all went to Texas as one person, and we all came back differently. It was a completely life-altering experience.
The last question I wanted to ask you is just a quote that I found from Roger Ebert saying that the entire film for him is an evocation of a mood. And how you create a mood on set. You always like people to be in a good mood. Sometimes you'll direct as Cary Grant or Jimmy Stewart. And how did you create a mood for Last Picture Show that it's imbued with that sort of sense of loss and heartbreak and people that are never going to leave this small town? And how did that?
Well, it was very well written. The script is very, the dialogue. Larry McMurtry, who wrote the novel, and worked with me on the screenplay. Larry writes the best regional dialogue of anybody since Mark Twain. So we had really good dialogue. And to tell you the truth, Liliana, I don't know. I just direct the picture and do what I think is best moment by moment.
You had great music choices.
I had done one picture before, Targets, and I had not used a score. I had a bunch of songs playing on the radio or in a jukebox or something. We didn't have any money, so we couldn't afford very good songs. But I like the idea, I like the effect that it had.
Yeah.
Which is that if you don't have a score, you just have music playing in the background because somebody's listening to the radio or a jukebox or something. It creates an atmosphere in which there's another world going on out there somewhere. And often I used a counterpoint to speak. Obviously, it was a sad scene, I used a happy song. If it was a happy scene, I used a sad song. Not all the time, but I tried to keep a counterpoint. We were lucky that we were able to get a really great selection of songs. I think there's 28 songs in the picture, and 9 by Hank Williams, who was a genius. And I thought that JC, the character that Sybil played, would be kind of anti-country. So she would listen to pop radio. And at the time the picture begins, I think it's November of 1951, number one hit in the North was Cold, Cold Heart, sung by Tony Bennett. And in the South, it was Cold, Cold Heart, sung by Hank Williams. That, I kept in touch, so to speak, with what was going on in the period that we were dealing with. Because the book isn't like that. The book is sort of generally 50s, and I wanted to be very specific. Because movies you need to be more specific, I think, in movies than you do in books.
Well, you started out as an actor, but you moved into directing because you didn't like auditioning. Are you glad you became a director?
Oh yeah, you get to play all the parts. And to this day I don't like to audition actors. I have to let them talk to you. I've cast a lot of actors without reading them. Tatum O'Neill and Sybil Shepherd and Madeline Kahn and John Ritter. I never read any of those people.
You just get a sense of quality.
You talk to them, you get a feeling for them, you know. I remember I was interviewing Madeline for What's Up, Doc? And I was laughing. She said, "What are you laughing at?" I said, "You're funny." She said, "I am." She never knew she was funny.
The last thing I'm gonna say is just, how does it feel to be, see this crowded house watching the last picture show?
At this time of morning, I think you're all crazy. But I'm very pleased that you're crazy.
Peter Bogdanovich, it's such an honor to know you, be friends with you, and I've learned so much from you and your fantastic books. Of course, this is Orson Welles, Who the Devil Made It, a Movie a Week with Peter Bogdanovich. What else? I'm missing a ton, I know.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please help the podcast out by submitting a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. If you go there now, I'm actually doing individual reviews of every classic film that I saw at the TCM Classic Film Festival. So if you want to know more about my in-depth thoughts regarding Rafter Romance, or The Last Picture Show, or The Man Who Knew Too Much, you can definitely find them there. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to listen to episodes early or have me review your favorite film? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And because I hit my $5 Patreon goal, I'll be live tweeting during TCM's screening of Creature from the Black Lagoon on May 4th at 8 p.m. Eastern. So be sure to follow me at ticklish_biz if you aren't already to join in. And there's still time to send in your TCM Classic Film Festival memories, which I'll be reading on next week's special bonus episode. So that's right, next time you'll be getting a special bonus episode next Wednesday as I close out the TCM Classic Film Festival 2017 with exclusive audio from the likes of Richard Dreyfuss, the Zucker Brothers, and more, as well as reading your TCM memories. Till next time.